Welcome to Women Leading the Way radio show, where each time you'll hear from successful women CEOs, executives, and professionals, where we'll discover how they do what they do to be successful in business. We'll be interviewing women who have overcome big challenges, women who have incredible stories of lessons learned in dealing with adversity. We'll even interview women who have started and grown successful organizations, and women who are C-level executives with unique talents and positions. Our goal is to bring successful businesswomen together to share how they're leading the way in business today.
Good morning and welcome to Women Lead Radio, brought to you by Connected Women of Influence. I'm Joni Cannell, your host for Real Life Lessons. Our topic today is Get Real About Dying. And our leading lady today is Dr. Dawn Gross with UC San Francisco. She's also launching her own company called Dialogues with a Y. Good morning, Dawn.
Good morning, Joni.
Hey, Dawn, you know, I want to give our listeners just a brief background about you and then have you tell them, like, what you're doing here. Because, first of all, to the listeners, our Dawn is the host of Dying to Talk Radio. She's also a hospice and palliative medicine physician, and, I mean, she does it all, right? We have women on this show who are just real achievers here. So Dawn is also a speaker, writer, and educator. But the topic is all death and dying. So the question I want to start out with, Dawn, is that you specialize in death. What inspired you to do that?
That's a great and appropriate question. Many people wonder, how does one become immersed in a topic such as this, where most think it's depressing, if not downright terrifying? And I can share with you that my experience of being involved in this work is neither depressing nor terrifying. It is absolutely inspiring and an honor. And I came to be involved in it through my professional training originally as a hematologist and bone marrow transplanter, witnessing people dying really painful, both physically and mostly emotionally, deaths. And I mean that both as the individual actually dying as well as the people they love witnessing their death. And as a physician, I started to realize an internal conflict that we kind of knew it was coming. We could read the writing on the wall, if you will, that the medical interventions we were trying to offer to, say, cure a disease or stave off a death was not going to work. And yet we were doing nothing to actually prepare the patient or the family. We would act like deer in the headlights, just like they would, except we were acting and they were living it. And at the same time as I was coming to that realization, my own internal sort of epiphany, if you will, of there's something not right here for me in how I'm practicing medicine and having integrity around that, my own father became terminally ill. And I say that he really was my first teacher in the specialty that I didn't even know existed at the time, called hospice and palliative medicine. And he started to walk me through the conversations and the questions that he wanted answered that no one in his medical care team was addressing with him. So he really trained me to start asking, and the result of which was extraordinary conversations I got to have with him that I realized I could start having with the people that I was responsible for caring for. And transformation happens in that moment when we actually become curious about the things that matter most in life. And those things become very accessible when we feel that time is short. And then suddenly, instead of being the Grim Reaper, I actually become a fairy godmother and start to make real wishes come true.
Ooh, I love it. The fairy godmother. I just spent the weekend in Disneyland.
It's like, so jealous.
Really, yeah, I know. That's so funny. Yeah, tell us more about what it means to be a fairy godmother instead of a Grim Reaper.
So it's really interesting when I, as an example, when I am working at UCSF and we have a lot of trainees, so medical students or new doctors, interns or residents, and fellows, those physicians choosing to specialize in the field of hospice and palliative medicine, as well as social workers and chaplains and nurses, people really coming to learn. And often when I ask their first day on the service with us, you know, what brought you here, they will pretty invariably say, well, I'm really scared to be here, but my friend said I should. And I kind of relate to it sort of like, no offense to Dennis, but it's like this thing where you know it will be good for you to do, but it's not like you're really excited to walk in the door and see your dentist. And I turn to these learners and I say, I hear you, I get it, and I, one, applaud your courage and the trust you have in your friend who recommended you come. And two, this won't sound like it's believable, but I assure you, we're going to have fun this time together on service. I promise you. I know it seems incomprehensible as you know what we're about to engage in with patients and families, but trust me. And it turns out on the palliative care team in particular, we're pretty rowdy because we recognize that we are all about celebrating life. And first and foremost, we focus on making sure people are physically, emotionally, and spiritually as comfortable as they possibly can be so that we can then dive in to the meat of what brings you meaning, what gives your individual and unique life value, and how can we enhance that? And maybe that includes getting you to Disneyland, quite honestly. Mm-hmm. And maybe that means going fishing. And if you're so ill that you can't physically leave the bed or you can't leave the hospital, then what can we do to bring the essence of those experiences that you crave or the people in your life that you cherish? How do we bring that to you right now? So getting really creative about making these wishes come true, about discovering really what they are and then manifesting them in any way imaginable. That's what it means to be a fairy godmother, aka palliative care and hospice physician.
Well, you know, I mean, something you've said repeatedly to me, but it sounds like you're really talking about living, not dying.
Absolutely. That the dying, for whatever reason, seems to be a useful perspective for human beings to get clarity on what it is about living that we love so much so that we don't sleep through our day or take it for granted or say, I'll get to it tomorrow or next month or next year. When dying is on the radar, then suddenly the urgency and the clarity unite. And then we can just make it happen where regular life stuff, those things that we say are essential and in many regards absolutely are to the day-to-day existence, but they take priority and precedence and end up suppressing to a detriment the things that really give us the essence of what it means to be alive. So it is absolutely always about you're alive right now, right now, right now. What do you want to do?
Well, you know, that can be really inspiring. People always talk about the near-death experience, changing their lives and suddenly having a new perspective and all. But you're saying that just the process of death, I mean, the cycle of life and seeing it around you is a reminder to us all the time. You know, we need to have time to live it up and reach our dreams and also just thinking about our work and what we want to get out of it. What is our purpose? All sorts of things that come to mind.
Absolutely. I mm-hmm. often tell people I feel that I get more out of my practice of hospice and palliative medicine than I can possibly provide. It is such an inspiration and a reminder, as you said, Joni, of helping me stay very present, stay very focused on the here and now, and to not get so caught up in the I have to's and I should's and I wishes that I could. And instead, well, why don't you? What's stopping you? What's in the way? And what can we do to take care of that now, right now?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's really good. I mean, even if it's just a perspective shift, Well, let me ask you something, Dawn, because one of the things that you've done, I mean, sounds like you've really achieved a lot and realized your dreams in a lot of ways. And one of them is creating a radio show. And since we're on a radio show, I'm just really curious, you know, what is your show about and who are your listeners?
So in a nutshell, the role model ideal of the program for those whom I'm dating with myself is Dr. Ruth. What Dr. Ruth did mm-hmm. for sex, I definitely aspire to do for death. I really applaud her authenticity, her expertise, bringing it to a subject that has been so taboo and yet is absolutely universal. One way or another, we all got here because of our biological, creative, you know, juices coming together. And to be able to create a space for people to ask questions that are really human, but we feel for a variety of cultural reasons, what have you, too afraid to ask. And yet there is an expert out there who really wants to be of support. So why not use a radio space where anonymity is possible, or people can listen and learn simply vicariously by listening, or even call in. I just thought this is brilliant. And in fact, it was in a conversation with another person who had approached me just wanting to become involved in the global space, if you will, of end-of-life care and conversations. And it was this person who suggested she was thinking of creating a radio show. And the minute she used those words radio show, because it had not occurred to me, a Dr. Ruth came to mind. And I said, do you mean like Dr. Ruth for death? And I said, count me in. Mm. And from that moment on, I couldn't get that idea out of my head. And pretty much anyone I spoke to in any context where they were just asked, what are you up to? And I would say the usual. And I said, but what I'm really excited about is creating a call-in radio show. And the way that things work, I think you know in your program and the women that you're speaking with, so much of how life happens is people talking to each other and sharing and connecting. And so you talk to enough people and enough people get inspired, then one person will say, well, I know this person who does this on the radio. Would you like me to make an introduction? And I'm like, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So that's how it literally evolved. The listeners, I can tell you from the very first program, was so humbling in that my view and vision for who I thought the program could touch and offer itself to just got blown wide open with the people who were actually listening and calling in and sharing their own stories or their own questions. It went well beyond the sliver of people I thought might dare to keep the knob turned to tuned to the station and not click away the minute they hear the topic. It was lay folk, you know, the people that I imagine that are living in the moment of caring, say, for a loved one who is ill or there's family strife of how do we navigate this, the tensions that come with caring for people living with serious illness are extraordinary. And yet, where can we talk about it and learn from each other, but also healthcare professionals from all different disciplines. I remember we had a respiratory therapist was one of the first callers, and a medical interpreter was another caller. And I was just so grateful because these are often hidden voices that are so essential and intimately involved in caring for people and families with serious illness and navigating really emotionally laden conversations, and yet they're not necessarily given the privilege of explicit training. How do you have this? Or even welcomed in that way. They're more utilized as, you know, an accessory in that you're going to do this job, you're going to do this job. And it just doesn't work. It's not that neatly defined in medicine. We are always collaborating and leaning on each other's expertise and knowledge. And goodness knows what patients and families are going to feel comfortable with, you know, sharing their fears or their elations. I can't tell you how many times we hear patients or families will not talk to the doctor. They only feel like they have 2 seconds with us anyway. But in the middle of the night, who are they turning to really divulge their greatest need or their greatest wish? It's the home health or the nursing aide who comes in the middle of the night, or even the person who's coming to sweep the room or change the garbage, or the people who are transporting them from one test to another. Suddenly, there's this intimate moment and there's this conversation happening. How do we support these medical team members so that they can be fully available to the family, as well as then navigate their own emotions that absolutely come up in these types of conversations? So it became a much broader audience than I anticipated, which is very exciting.
Well, Dawn, you know, you just answered about 5 questions that I had. And I think this is important for our listeners, because really my show was about real life, right? Kind of, we're talking about death, but it really plays into real life. And real, for our purposes, is people need to be resilient, empowered, authentic, and limber to succeed in life, no matter what path they take. And you're talking about handling death. I mean, you just mentioned a bunch of things here. Obviously, the resilience factor of handling a difficult topic, but having that empowerment to make decisions and live and choose what you want to do in this process and how you want to react to it. Having these authentic, intimate conversations you were talking about. And then the limber is, you know, just the flexibility and the collaboration of a team of people that work together to make this a positive experience for folks. Let me take a pause in our show for a second, because there might be some people who are listening who want to contact you after the show. So, Dawn, how would you like people to contact you?
Thank you, Joni. There are 2 different websites, I think, that people might find most useful, and my contact information can be found there. The first is my personal webpage, which is called Doctor As You Wish. It's just DR and then the phrase As You Wish, ASYOUWISH.com. And the other is a professional, the business that I'm starting with some wonderful colleagues, Nancy Belza and Paul Puccinelli, our new business called Dialogues with a Y, so DYALOUGUES, excuse me, .com, where we are supporting individuals as well as communities and businesses in how to have these conversations about what matters most in life.
Oh, great. Thank you to the listeners. If you didn't catch her contact details, we'll have Dawn's information listed in our show notes after the show, so you can always go there. But I wanted to tap on something that you've told me in the past, because, you know, we think about death and older people, right, because that's the natural course of things. But it's not just for the old. I mean, you say that you think even teens should take a course in death education. You know, why so young, and what's that all about?
Yeah, even younger than teens, I would argue, but we're starting mm-hmm. with teens. And which,
okay.
In that, another dear friend and colleague, Dr. Jessica Zitter, and I created a course called Death Ed. So, again, like sex ed, but death. And I have to say, when we approached educators, directors of schools, what have you, you know, the moment we say death ed, they look at it. They look at both of us somewhat cross-eyed and afraid. And the minute then we add in, you know, like sex ed, but for death, they get it immediately, because this is part of life, just like sex mm-hmm. is. And when you can take that taboo subject, create real curriculum, which includes language and education, here are the terms, here are the steps, here is the reality of what sex is and your organs and your body and how it all works. We know how to do that now very, very well. And we know the outcomes of when we do that well and when we ignore it. And the same is true for death. There are biologic things that we can teach people about. There are medical systems that we engage with that we can teach people about. And there's language we can teach people how to use, how to start what are perceived as difficult conversations, like talking about sex, and normalize it. I look at my own teenagers now who have been through years of a curriculum of sex education, and their comfort in talking about this subject is extraordinary. it is vastly superior to my own, where I had, you know, one 2-day course in fifth grade or something like this on sex
ed.
Like there was no real curriculum to have me learn how to have conversations with my peers as well as with people older and younger than me. They rock in that conversation. They are intelligent. They are educated consumers, if you will. They're knowledgeable and they are thoughtful, most importantly. And the same is true for death, because how we die now, particularly in this country, because of the extraordinary medical and scientific advances we've developed in the years, how we die has dramatically changed. And so we actually need to understand the language and the biologic mechanisms and how to learn to advocate for ourselves, because otherwise it is very, very easy and common to get swept up in the moment, like sex, but different. You just get swept along, and the next thing you know, you're not in control. And so death ed is all about having us be intelligent and be in control for ourselves and the people we love, so we can learn how to advocate for them. And the amazing thing, like sex, is we are not born afraid to talk about death. If you look at young children, it's not that there's some DNA, you know, program in us that says, and here's a subject off limits, don't go there. No, we are inherently curious about everything, just like sex, just like death, just like life. And the challenge is somewhere along the way, society creates a taboo expectation about, no, this is something we don't talk about. And the opportunity in creating a real curriculum in upper grade school, middle school, high school, which is where we began, was in high school, is to normalize this conversation like everything else so that we can maintain the dialogue throughout our entire lives. The opportunity in teaching the teens, because they are so primed to be self-advocates as well as advocates for the world, they're just hungry to be right and knowledgeable about everything, is that you train them. They then go into their own homes and start teaching their parents and their grandparents how to do this. And ideally then, they continue to do it for themselves and then their own children. And then you've transformed a culture in a generation or two. That's the idea.
Yeah, it's just like the environment. You know, the kids at school started learning how to do all the recycling and checking in on all that. And then all of a sudden, the parents had to take note and start doing it too. So
exactly.
Bringing it in sort of with the young folks. You know, you make
exactly.
me think as you're talking, Dawn, that my daughter went to her first funeral when she was an infant, and
yeah.
then went to another one when she was just maybe a preschooler. So at that point she was cognizant to be able to have this conversation. And so it
yeah.
does happen even when you're a kid, and we have to have these conversations, and having a vocabulary like you're talking about, having ways to talk about it that take away the fear factor or the hush-hush, like, oh, we can't talk about it, actually
right.
is very empowering. I appreciate you saying that.
Thank you. I look at these events that happen not just to older people, as you said. In my young child's grade school, you know, a teacher died suddenly. How is the school community going to address it? And how are the children to suddenly have a teacher not come back? You can't just say they're not coming back. I mean, you could, but is that really going to serve? And in fact, when you have an open conversation and explain that this person died, you know, when I raised that with my own son, I said, you know, tell me about this teacher. He's like, you know, she was never my own personal teacher, but you know what I really loved about her? She always did the lice checks, and I'm really going to miss her because she was so thorough. Do you think we could go visit? Do you know where they're going to bury her? I mean, it was so seamless a conversation for him that to keep it that open and authentic, and how lovely. I hear that time and time again, and it's more, I think, getting the parents or the adults comfortable with allowing the conversation to unfold as it likely will naturally do for young children.
Well, Dawn, we have just a couple minutes left. I have one more question for you that I think is really relevant to the show, because we're all about women leaders. And, you know, that there might be different expectations on women than on men when we're dealing with death. And I was wondering if you've had any experience with that, or you would have any advice to our women leaders who are listening in that might be specific to them?
It's a really wonderful question, and I appreciate your asking it. The automatic expectation in our society, and I'm just speaking here culturally, you know, is that in general, women have a caretaker role. Now, whether that's biologic or not, I am not going to comment on. I can tell you I grew up in a family of a stereotypically role-reversed home where my mother was the breadwinner and my father was very much the more of a nurturer, caretaker role, if you will. So that being said, culturally, in general, it is expected that women will take on caregiving, whether it's for a child or for an older parent. And how that shows up then in the workplace, because most women are also working outside the home, can be much more complicated than for men. I absolutely see that. And so one of the things I'm very excited and grateful for here in living in California and watching some of the newer companies lead the way in recognizing the importance of family dynamics and family leave and how we nurture whole family resilience and caregiving and caring is to recognize the need to be in more than one place at one time without penalizing people or assuming that they no longer have vision or care for their work outside the home if they also need to pay attention to work within the home. And so creating very creative structures of how we can work and collaborate and create teams so that we can duplicate ourselves and be much more dynamic and expand what we're capable of doing, I think is the way of the future. I think women actually know how to do that. We are always juggling by definition. And so to learn from women and to create these types of environments so we can manifest all the things that we are committed to in life and all the things we care about and people we care about, I think that is the way women can lead in the future.
Wow, Dawn, you hit on a really important topic for women leaders. I mean, for everyone, really, but there is help out there is what you're saying. And we can build a team of people to help us through these difficult situations and just with life in general. So the message I'm hearing is ask for it. Go find it and ask for help. Don't just try to take it all on yourself. And that's a lesson we keep need to hear all the time. I mean, just for women leaders that we tend to shoulder so much. So I really appreciate that.
We shoulder it, and I think we worry that by asking for help, we appear either incapable or incompetent, that we can't do it ourselves. And I think that's the cultural piece that needs to change, that the power of leading and being part of a high-functioning collaborative team is an extraordinary skill, and that that's not about you can't do it yourself. It's about honoring the people that are really skilled to do these different things, and that will be better when we all do what we're great at instead of all trying to do it ourselves and demonstrating our own capabilities. And again, that I think that's a cultural transformation of recognizing there's value in sharing the load instead of pioneering it and doing it yourself.
Well, thanks, Dawn, because I hear that there's a bigger picture here, more of a cultural global one as well as a personal one here. And you know, in terms of the real life, I mean, we do have the power. We are empowered to make change and to take things on and make decisions and take control of a situation that there isn't some control of, but we can control our reactions to things and
yeah,
how we experience our lives with the situations that are presented to us. So, Dawn, that's our show for today. I'd like to say thank you for being our leading lady today. Thanks, Dawn.
Thank you for having me, Joni. It's a real pleasure to be with you.
Oh, great. It was actually really interesting and inspiring despite the topic here. So special thanks to all our listeners, too. We'll be back again for another Women Lead Radio show. We're here every Monday at 9 a.m. and Friday at 2 p.m. I'm Joni Cannell, host of Real Life Lessons. Thank you for listening. And remember, real women are resilient, empowered, authentic, and limber.
Women Leading the Way is produced by Connected Women of Influence. the premier private membership organization where like-focused business-to-business executive and professional women connect, collaborate, and cultivate a vast network of high-level affiliations, resources, and professional relationships. For more information about Connected Women of Influence, please visit our website at connectedwomenofinfluence.com.